patience is underrated. Like, how do you get success? I worked hard. Or, you know, there's all these different things. No one really talks about patience, do they?
Occasionally, you've got to remind each other that, look, the reason you're doing this is not for today or tomorrow or even next week or next month. It's for 5 years' time.
The land of opportunity. I'm not talking about America. I'm talking about Dubai. I sit down with House and House, their two founders, Simon Baker and Luke Remington. We speak about how they went from zero, a startup, to a multi-million dollar business. Be happy, never content, and make sure you are subscribing. Before we start this week's podcast, I have to give a special mention to our sponsors. iSecure Vehicles. They are a brilliant company, a family-run business, and they specialize in vehicle safety and security throughout the UK. I know this company very well, and I also know the people behind the brand. If you've been following me on my podcast journey and on social media, you will know that I love cars and so does my network. This is why I'm very, very excited to be working with iSecure Vehicles, and this is why we have chosen them to be our sponsors for the Stephen Sully Study podcast. Their team are professionals, experts, and they're efficient. Once their product is installed on your car, your vehicles, you will have the peace of mind that your asset is protected. Trust me, do not wait until it's too late. Get protection now. For more information about their products, including dash cameras, undetected immobilizers, and also car tracking systems, head over to iSecure-vehicles.co.uk and remember to mention the Stephen Sully Study podcast sent you. Right, welcome back to the podcast, the Stephen Sully Study. We're here at Woodbury House, Mayfair Gallery, and we've got two incredible guests in front of me right now. House and House's founders, we've got Simon Baker and Luke Remington. So you're here in London. I am really intrigued about this conversation because I've had a mixture of people on my podcast, from footballers to boxers to film stars to people that have done mad challenges. I even mentioned to you that I've got someone coming on who sadly has got a terminal situation and he's about to share his story with me. So I'd like to have a mixture because the Stephen Sully Study is my study into interesting individuals and people. I was going to use the term rags to riches, but I don't know if that is a kind of an accurate statement. I want to say this though, you're two individuals, the three of you as founders,
indeed, yeah.
That had an idea, went over to another part of the world, started a brand, scaled the brand. The brand's doing extremely well, and it seems like you've got that market at your feet and you've got so many options. But I know as a business person that successful businesses, it's not as simple as that. So I wanted to hear your story from the get-go, how you scaled it, some of the challenges, and where you are right now, and where some of the ambitions and some of the goals and some of the what the vision is for the future. So anyway, long introduction. Welcome aboard the podcast, guys.
Cheers.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having us today.
A bit overwhelming comparing us with boxers and athletes and all these people you've...
True. Yeah, I hope a pair of estate agents doesn't let the side down, but let's see how we get on.
So when the term's rags to riches, it's probably not necessarily the rags. We can't probably say, you know, we were on the streets and I think, you know, speaking for myself, you know, I wasn't definitely not the most intelligent person in the world. And I think I mentioned to you before we spoke that if you saw my GCSE results, they were pretty horrendous. So basically just got into a estate agency very quickly at young age, 17, left school, couldn't see the idea of going to university really helping me, mm-hmm. getting loans, probably going to the student bars. That's probably the way it would have gone, and maybe coming out with a degree or maybe not coming out with a degree. I've done estate agency. I'm 42 now, and I started when I was 17. I think I was earning around £300 a month. So, and I also mentioned to you that the day I started, I was given, I think, about 2,000 envelopes and 2,000 stamps, and I was told to put the stamps onto the envelopes. So I think even the tea or the person making the coffee would have had, you know, the job above mine. So it wasn't rags, but it definitely wasn't, you know, I didn't have lots of money and I didn't have my parents throwing money at me. My parents were pretty middle class. And I think always the attitude in the family was grinds. Just go out there and work your pulls off, and then you'll get some kind of success. So it goes on and on from there, Steve. I was in a part of southwest Wales called Tenby. It was kind of a holiday home place. You wouldn't see many properties at those kind of figures now of £1 million. They're all quite reasonably cheap, you know. Mm. But I suppose this was a long time ago, but £100,000-£200,000. So commissions weren't big, and it wasn't anything that, you know, you'd be writing home about, that's for sure. I'm sure Simon's probably upbringing was slightly different. He's got a lot bigger brain than I have. So
I don't know. Very nice of you. I'm not sure about that. But yeah, I mean, I grew up in the Cotswolds. So again, lived in a very nice place, and until a lot of people was very privileged. So had a nice family and the rest of it, but certainly very normal middle class. I moved to Dubai at the age of 19, which was after working in Swindon of all places, doing a double glazing job, which was good. Good practice for your first sales experience, definitely. So I was going through, through the ringer, if you like, in terms of training and all that kind of stuff. Commission only jobs, and I was quite comfortable with that. So going to Dubai, which I think for a lot of people is very scary. You've got this idea that, you know, you're commission only. You know, obviously there's no security net of a salary. The plus side to that is you can make a huge amount of money in commission. Estate agents in Dubai can earn 10 or 20 or 100 times more than you might do in the UK. But of course, there is a risk doing that. Me at 19, I didn't have anything to lose. Went to Dubai with £1,000 in my pocket, probably spent it in the first few nights out, and then said, right, let's get cracking and find a way to do this. And I looked around and I thought, well, what's the most expensive thing you can sell? Having a bit of sales experience, I was like, right, probably property, but wasn't quite ready to get into super yachts and private jets at 19. So I thought, right, so let's get into property. Got my first property job for a very, very small company there. I had about 3 staff. No one wanted to give a 19-year-old a job. Over in Dubai, typically you've got to be 21 to rent a car. So I couldn't even rent a car. You know, you've got to be 21 to go to the pub or whatever. So I got a job for a very, very small company. Worked there for a couple of years, proved I could do it. And a bit later on, had the privilege of meeting Luke and James. We all worked together and decided that, there's probably a better way. So I think I'd been in Dubai probably about 7 or 8 years at that point when I met James and Luke. And then we set the company up, which has now just hit its 10-year anniversary. So that's where we're at today.
Founded in 2013. I'm going to read you a small article here that I found, which was written on the 3rd of April, 2023, from Zaiwa. You might be familiar with them, this publication. House and House Real Estate, record best ever month in 10-year history. And it goes on to say this: March saw the company's company experience its strongest result to date, with overall revenue exceeding set targets by 30%. I mean, if I'm allowed to ask you the numbers, are you allowed to share some of those numbers with us?
Yeah, we're quite a different company in that. In fact, we don't like to publish the numbers. And the reason we don't like to publish the numbers, and in Dubai, you can see it all over Instagram, you can see it over LinkedIn. And a reason a lot of companies do it, Steve, is because they're trying to attract employees to think, wow, look how much money they're making. I could be one of those people. We don't do it because we're kind of looking at it from the public perspective and saying, well, Steve probably doesn't want to give his house to sell to these brash. Estate agents aren't light necessarily, are they? I think you've got politicians, maybe double glazing salesmen, then estate agents.
Probably,
so,
yeah.
So we don't like to put the figures out there.
It's more that we're all quite down to earth, we're quite humble, and it's not the way we were brought up probably to go out and go, oh, you know, we did £4 million in a month, but, you know, maybe it was about that kind of number. And I think that people probably have a hard time processing that.
We're on schedule. What are we? We're 3 months away from the end of the year. And
yeah,
I think
we'll hit our targets this year,
50 million sterling turnover. So it's a lot of difference from 2013 when we started. You know, that the road has been, well, I've never done it before, but I think I've probably had the conversation numerous times. I had it with the sales director recently, and we were talking, and he said, if it failed, would you start it again? I just don't think I could. And I hate to say that, because I think, first of all, I don't want to think it is going to happen, and I don't think it will. But would I start it again at 42? I don't think I'd see my kids too much longer. That's my honest opinion. It's been a journey and the numbers sound great and, you know, everything's doing well. And, you know, we got a lot of employees. I think we were on about 347 employees when I left Dubai on Friday. It's cutthroat. There's a lot of tears daily with staff. There's a lot of joy. There's a lot of, you know, someone summed it up to me. It's champagne or razor blades. And literally today, you could be like, I'm going to finish. It is. It's a crazy, crazy world. You know, you're not paying tax and you've just got some like ridiculous, ridiculous figures being earned. But on the other hand of it, we don't want to kind of put out to the world, you know, or to people coming over that you're all going to make figures because you're not. There's going to be 10 arriving in a month and maybe 7 will go within 6 months, maybe 6. So we do kind of like try and be as honest with people as possible. We're making lots of money as a company, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to make money. You've got to bring quite a lot to the table as well. So yeah, we're doing okay. I'm sure that will grow. I think, you know, we'll be 100 million in the next couple of years. I honestly do. Simon, James and myself, we're all quite different individuals. So Simon likes pushing the accelerator. I'm kind of, you know, a bit in the middle. And I think James is more kind of like, let's push the brake or the handbrake for a bit. So I think you've got three quite different individuals that we don't argue. And we've never really had an argument since we started in 2013. But we can each bring to the table something that when I speak to a lot of businesses that start with partnerships, they're like, how many arguments? Like, have you been close to, you know, closing the company because of a decision? We've never actually had that, thankfully.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we are all quite different, but we all get on well. And we've been fortunate that we've met three different people that have been able to all work together for the more for the common good of the company. So I think a lot of the, we said originally, there's three of us. So the beauty with that is there's always a majority of a decision. So, and that, you know, once we do make a decision, everyone should respect it and just move on. And I think that's quite important. I think if you just have two of you as business partners and you hit as loggerheads, you'd probably be quite stuck at this 50-50 position, wouldn't you? So that's actually the advice, even though they always say three is a crowd, don't they? But I think actually, if you all respect each other, we respect the fact that the company is much more important than one person's opinion on a certain thing, and that the right decision to be made for the company, you know, for the best of the business, for the betterment of the business going forward, it is the only thing that matters, really.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So House & House is a Dubai real estate agency, and the part of the reason why I pulled up this article and then kind of tried to segue into talking about the numbers. I'm like you. I would never turn around to someone on the podcast or maybe in the street and say, do you know how much Woodbury House has turned over? Because it's just a bit wanky.
Yeah.
And also, it's not the British thing to do, right?
Yeah.
If I was American, it might be a little bit different.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I love money. I think it's important. I like what money can do for you. Buy you nice stuff, give you opportunities, send your kids to private education, all that great stuff. But there's something about the British culture that we kind of a bit more reserved. Reason why I like to slightly talk about it with certain people is because at the end of the day, success means can mean it's subjective, right? It could be different to so many different people out there. But one thing you can't deny is the scoreboard, which is money. Yeah. So let's call it, I know I'm not going to hold you to it, but 50 million quid you're turning over, right?
Yeah.
Got over 300 people working for you, which is a lot.
Yeah.
And you're one of the biggest, and I think you're going to be the biggest property real estate agency company in Dubai, in the UAE. And you've got offices all dotted around. Plus, you've got a TV documentary called Dubai Hustle, which we'll get onto later on.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of accolades, a lot of success, a lot of medals that you guys have got. So my question to you is this. In 10 years, how have you gone from an idea to the £50 million turnover brand and heading to 100 million? It couldn't have been all that simple.
No, I think it's definitely a journey, as Luke mentioned earlier. I mean, we started off with three of us sat in a very, very small office that we'd rented, because you have to rent an office to get your license in Dubai, sort of linked together. So very small office. We'd gone and bought a couple of computers from the local Carrefour supermarket, and off we went. And I guess, you know, the roots probably changed along the way, but the plan was always the same. Is that, you know, we felt like we wanted to build a company for brokers, in terms of build the best platform. And if you could build the best platform in the market where brokers actually wanted to work and thrived within that brand, then you could grow and grow and grow and grow. So that was it. We started with the three of us, and we uh, you know, I guess the routes change, but the destination's the same or whatever, if that makes sense.
I've got a friend of mine who's been living in Dubai. So our first ever art show, Woodbury House, was in Dubai.
Oh, really?
We done it in 2015 with a restaurant called La Catena de Foie Bois.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And that Gold Rodeo, which I'll show you afterwards, that was actually one of our first ever sales to the owner of that restaurant. And then a UK guy bought it, and that's why it's back here.
Yeah.
So Dubai, we have an affinity with this brand to over there. And what this guy said to me, who helped us put the show together, is Dubai, and it probably still is now, is the new America.
Yeah.
He said, people talk about the US American dream, the land of opportunity, but now Dubai is the land of opportunity.
Yeah.
And at the time, I'm thinking, that's a bit of a bold statement, mate. You're making there. Like, Americans always been known as the land of opportunity. But the more I go back there, the more it changes for the better, the more opportunity I see. And funny thing is, off the back end of that show, this local guy who's in a very sharp suit, Baluti shoes on. I don't know what suit he had on, but definitely had Balutis on because we were talking about them. Lovely watch on it, etc. Then he invited me to his offices a couple of days later. And as I went up this building, I think it was something to do with like one of the old embassies over there. And I went up to the top and he was all in his gown and stuff. And he was like a VIP there. And he said, the difference between here to America or even to the UK is you'll get access to billionaires or VIP a lot quicker than you would in other parts of the world because we're very welcoming and we're very all about business and expansion.
Yeah.
And it was at that moment I thought, there is so much opportunity here. There isn't barriers.
Yeah.
Is Dubai, the UAE, the new American dream?
I think, you know, when you were saying that, I think what we did right, and I'm not saying it was planned because it definitely wasn't planned. There is luck that the three of us met in 2013. We didn't think in 2008, right, guys, let's move out to Dubai in 2013 because we see Dubai becoming the new US. So that's really worked in our favor. So let's not make any bones about it. There's a lot of agencies opening today, or there's a lot of businesses coming into Dubai today. But what we've now got is we've got 10 years of experience and we're going into the golden era. So, you know, the market is ridiculous. We've got people annoyed with Europe. We've got political issues. We've got, you know, there's so many issues that are going on in the world today that, okay, Dubai's opened their arms and said, come here and live. Where else do you want to be? So, yeah, there's a lot of going on in Saudi at the moment. You've got a lot going on in Kuwait. There's, you know, the headlines over there. It's like mega cities being built. And, you know, that the line in Saudi, you've had the Qatar World Cup. You know, you've got some of the biggest, you were talking about boxing earlier. You know, whenever you see any kind of big boxing events now, they can pull out the purse strings, right? And there's a lot of places. Everyone else is cutting costs. Can't do this, can't do that, can't spend this. What's the Middle East doing? Throwing money at it. You know, they're bringing in some of the biggest footballers. Yeah, I'm not saying they're in their prime, but they're bringing in some of the biggest footballers, Neymar, into the Saudi league. Ronaldo, like, it is unheard of. So 2013, Dubai now is a lot different. You know, Simon was obviously there 2005,
I was there. So, I mean, certainly when I went there, I felt like I'd left the Cotswolds, a nice little country village, and landed in Abu Dhabi in the middle of the night I think it was the 26th of June, 2005. And it was baking hot. It was, red hot in the middle of summer. I remember driving from Abu Dhabi in the middle of the night through to Dubai, just thinking, oh my God, what have I done? There's just towers everywhere under construction. And then you had that boom period of like 2006 through to 2008. And then obviously GFC, global financial crisis hit. And by the end of 2008, I think it was about November in Dubai, everything caught up with Dubai and the market dropped something crazy like 70%. And then we went for a sort of lull period, and probably from when we set up the company, which was quite busy for a few years. But then we had probably 5 or 6 years from sort of 15 to 20 of a bit of a sort of cooling off, and, you know, maybe Dubai had lost its direction a little bit. And I think that you're completely right in terms of, you know, boom time now and the fact that Dubai is as a land of opportunity. And I think what's really even more exciting, it's only just catching on. So you'd speak to people in London 5 or 10 years ago, certainly when I went 18 years ago, they'd be like, where the hell's that? You know, is it? And if you're speak to an American, they haven't got a clue about the Middle East, have they? They just think, oh, I wouldn't go there. So, but slowly it's catching on. And the exciting thing for Dubai is they've got this target to hit 6 million people by 2040. And if that happens, it's going to virtually double the population from today. So I think there is a lot of opportunity. And even in the UK now, you'd speak to people who 5 years ago would have gone, oh, I'd never go and live there, to now they're going, actually, let's start looking at it. It looks all right, this place. You don't have to pay any tax. And, you know, you can have a nice pool in your garden and all that kind of stuff.
It's got a kind of strange... It's strange, Steve. I was on a ski lift a couple of years ago, and I was on the ski lift and speaking to this guy. He was a doctor from somewhere up north, Manchester, it could have been. And whenever someone says, where do you live? And I say Dubai, it could be a 50-50. They hate it or they love it. I think there's a lot of preconceived ideas about Dubai. I think there's the story of the guy that was supposedly getting it on with his missus in the back of a taxi, goes to jail. And then you've got someone that's, you know, maybe expanded on that, said he got stoned and got put, you know, buried in sand. And, you know, all these kind of things you heard about Dubai in the past, they're not real. It's not the truth. It's not, you know, the Emiratis are some of the nicest people you will ever meet. You're living in a country that's ultra safe. You kiss your kids, they go to school, you know you're picking them up at 3 o'clock. You know, there's places in the world that you don't know what's going on. You know, so whatever your beliefs or what, you know, what you like or what you don't like, there are rules in Dubai. You know, you go into the male or the female toilet. There's no other door to the unisex, okay, which we've just seen in the bar that we come from. And I'm not against that, but I'm just saying it's not there. And if you don't like it, you're not going. But if you want to go and you want to have 360 plus days of sunshine and you want to go to some of the nicest restaurants in the world and you don't want to have any fear about your safety, come here. And if you don't want to pay tax, come here. And if you want some of the best education for your kids, come here. And, you know, the list literally could go on and on and on. So that is a reason that at the moment they're saying 100,000 people have come in. Hundreds of, you know, Si's talking about that kind of figure. It sounds crazy, but what they've shown is when they plan to do something, they do it. Is it because of the money aspects? Maybe they can throw money at things, but they do it particularly well. That's the reason you drive down, you know, the main roads in Dubai and you kind of see the leader's faces because people love him. You know, we love him, right? We can go there. We can open a business that arguably we opened in 2013 in the UK. We're not going to be turning over 40 or 50 million quid. We don't even know where it's going to be going. We don't know if we'll be happy in life. We don't know. So I'm not against here, but I 100% believe that had I stayed, would I be in the position I'm in today? No. And, you know, do I think I'd have given people the opportunity to become millionaires working for me? No. So it's given us a massive springboard. Did it, it came by chance that the three of us met up in a company. We were working at a company and we went to sit on a desk this size and the three of us are there. And after a year, we're like, I think we could do this better. I think we were estate agents and we knew the way we wanted to be treated. So where you've got your kind of your CEO or you've got your different management, sales is fierce, right? You got finger pointing, you get shouted out, you get balls thrown at you, you get glass of water thrown. Like the figures are on the board. You've got to make success of this. We saw them. Well, it's probably not for us. So let's make something that people want to work for us and they're going to enjoy working for us and they're going to stay working for us. And that's what I think we've done really well is we've got really, really good people and we've managed to hold on to them.
You used a word there, which I was going to come on to, which is perception.
Okay.
And I think between Ibiza and Dubai, they are the two most regular places that I've visited in my life.
Yeah.
And they've all got their attributes and they've all got the phenomenal elements, both got the sun. They're both incredible in my opinion. And when I've spoken to certain people for the first time about Dubai or the UAE as a whole, I do agree with the 50-50 split. Right. You get someone goes, what annoys me is when I hear, nah, not for me, not good. And I'll say, oh, have you been? No. So well, why is it not for you? Because I don't like their rules and stuff. And it's that perception. It's different if you're going on holiday, right?
Yeah.
Like you heard about the person that might have smoked a joint 10 years ago and he's gone through customs. They're taking his blood test there and then. They found a little segment and he's gone to jail for 25 years. I mean, it's a complete blown up exaggeration of the truth.
Yeah.
But people ride on these kind of fairy tale stories and it kind of puts people off. But as a business person, right? Knowing you're going to go there as a business, some of the rules, some of maybe some of the laws, some of the... perception. Well, did it ever play in the back of your mind and thought, I need to, because like, for example, bouncing a check.
Yeah.
In the UK, if someone, I mean, we don't really have checks anymore, but if someone bounced a check, you're just going to be a bit pissed off at someone. And you're going to be like, can you send me another one, mate? Because that one's gone.
Yeah. But to be fair, that has changed a lot in Dubai. So yeah, you're completely right. When I first went there, the idea of someone bouncing a check, you know, they'd all sign it really carefully. And it was very, well, you could have been, you know,
and
banged
they're sweating
up for it.
As they're
but
doing
then,
it.
But then obviously it's in the real world, the banking system is obviously, it was is a bit behind in Dubai. It's a little bit archaic and it's slowly getting there. People don't really use checks anymore. Or certainly that, you know, if they bounce, it's not really a criminal offence. So it's changed a lot. I mean, it's not that idea is not completely gone, but it's certainly not quite the same as it
but
used
what,
to be.
It's yeah, a less, it's a life lesson, isn't it? Right. I give you a check. I shouldn't bounce it. I owe you the money. Otherwise, I wouldn't give you the check. So is the UK system right for me to give you something that I know intentionally is not going to clear, but I've you actually, there's goods or services traded or whatever it is. So a lot of the things they do, you actually look at this, you think, it's the right reason.
And you touched on the laws and stuff. I mean, let's be honest, is that, you know, the reason, actually, ironically enough, I thought, oh, well, everyone wants to go there, a bit like my dad working in the Saudi in the 60s or whatever, because he was, oh, I'm going to work there and don't pay any tax and get paid a lot of money. So I would have thought that's the big reason. But actually in recent years, you know, since, especially post-COVID, most people have wanted to, have been coming, the two main things they tell you is safety and security, for mainly for their family, as Luke mentioned, for their families. So they know that they, you know, the good schooling, good healthcare, safety. Now those rules was what creates that safety. And yet in the UK, or you know, a lot of major cities around the world, where you're having all kinds of problems with knife crime and gun crime and these different things. And then, but then those are the same people complaining that there aren't the rules in place. A bit ironic, really, isn't it?
Yeah. It going back to the check thing. So my dad is really old school. Yeah. He's got part of a security company, and he took a chance with a Bulgarian guy many years ago who came over with hardly anything. Massive, massive guy. Like, wouldn't want, like a real life Hulk. He's huge, and you wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of him. Perfect person to have in your security company. And anyway, when they set up this business together, the Bulgarian called George ended up giving my dad a contract, and my dad went, don't work like that. My handshake is my word, and that's it. They shook their hands, and it's been flourishing ever since. And George was like, I really admire that about your dad, because there's many people that will fuck you over if you don't have contracts and stuff in place. Now, I don't recommend that for most people to do that, because I think the culture now is completely different. But what I liked about Dubai with the whole bounce and the check, if you really think about it, a check is kind of your handshake say-so to say that I haven't got the money here, as in physically in my hand, but I've got something that represents the money. Here's a handshake and bank that, because it's good as my word. And when people bounce a check, it's basically saying that your word means fuck all, and I'm basically, I've got no integrity. And what I like about Dubai, it holds people accountable to their integrity.
100%. And you look at the things you talked about, the weed on the guy's foot, and you know, it got blown up and it got exaggerated. But if you want to smoke weed, stop off in Amsterdam on the way to Dubai, do what you want to do. And then when you come to Dubai, don't do it. Yeah. They say don't do drugs, so don't come here if you're going to do drugs.
Yeah, yeah.
If you want to come here and eat in a nice restaurant and have a bottle of wine, fine, do it. You know, if you want to finish another bottle of wine or another bottle of wine, and maybe you want to kind of be a bit loose-footed when you come out of the restaurant, you're probably not going to have someone that's going to jump you because you're wearing a $100,000 watch. Mm. This means a lot to people these days. In Dubai, it doesn't matter where you are, you will not feel unsafe, regardless of if you're wearing a watch for $100,000, whether your wife's got a Birkin handbag. You can't, where in the world can you actually, you can't get in Ibiza. Where actually can you go? I don't know. Where can I feel today I can go on the map, say I'm going to go on holiday, and I can wear that nice watch that I've worked really hard for from the checks that have been paid for. Where can you do it? You can't.
True.
So a lot of these things, like, you know, the 50-50 or Dubai, sometimes you used to get into these, not arguments, but you get into a debate to be like, okay, so what is it you don't like? Well, I just don't like this. And then you're like, but you haven't really thought about it, mate. You've just got a story maybe your dad or your granddad has told you, because that's probably what I heard. It was those stories from years and years ago. You've got Bush has gone into Afghanistan, and you've got the Taliban, and you've got 9/11. And now basically everyone from the UAE is going to blow you up at some stage. It's bollocks, isn't it?
Totally.
It's complete bollocks. But we don't have the media out there. We don't have any media. But Steve, I can go on holiday. I can forget to lock my house. I can leave my cars unlocked. I have no problem when I return. Like you can't, you know, that's more than what you can buy in life, isn't it? You know, your children's safety, your safety. It's just, would I want to leave? No. I love coming back here. I love seeing the architecture. I love seeing the busy streets. I've got that kind of childhood memories. God, look how busy. People stopping off, getting a coffee before they're going on the tube. That, I miss that. I love that. And I love the UK. I love walking past Buckingham Palace a minute ago, see the change of guards. But get to Dubai.
Yeah. Talking about sales reps in particular at House & House, seen a few different articles, and they can, you know, the commissions can range anything from like 6,000 to maybe 100,000 and beyond a month,
yeah,
which is phenomenal money. If yeah, you're on 50 grand, 100 grand a month in any walk of life, I don't care who you are, that's decent, decent, decent money. I mean, really and truly, if you're on a grand a week, that's pretty, pretty decent money.
Yeah.
Are some of the people that are coming over, not necessarily for House & House, but just generally speaking to Dubai, or maybe House & House, where they're looking at the money, but then they're looking at the sun, they're looking at the yachts, the cars, the wealth, the women, or if it's the birds, they're looking at the fellas. Yeah. They're looking at more the lifestyle, and they're getting a bit, what's that called? A shiny object syndrome, like the magpie, looking at something that's really shiny and get drawn towards it. Because I've seen a lot of podcasts before where people have gone over there with this dream, it all comes crashing down, and they come back with their suitcase like, oh my God, Dubai has just chewed me up and spat me back out. Are people sometimes misled in their own mind what Dubai can do for them because of lifestyle?
I think like any major city is quite expensive. So if you've moved somewhere and you know you haven't got a huge amount of savings to fall back on, then you know, you should get there and hit the ground running and start working really hard to start with, right? And it seems more logical to start earning some money, you know, get yourself settled, get a nice place to live, and get, you know, everything you need in life sorted before you start hitting the beach clubs and the bottle service. You know, that would obviously be the right way around. I think, unfortunately, like you said, there's a lot of young people who get there, get really overexcited. You know, first time living away, sometimes from mum and dad. You know, I think I was hearing now the average age for first time buyers in the UK is 37. So there's probably plenty of people still living with their parents. Mm. They're let out into this big wide world of Dubai and the sunshine and beach clubs and nightclubs and everything else. And it's quite easy to be spending a lot of money and putting yourself in that position, I guess.
Yeah.
I wish I could write a contract with every new employee that comes out and say, right, give me 1 year of your life. And in that year, I don't want you to go out drinking. I want you to be in bed at a certain time. I want you to eat healthily. There could be, you know, you could go on probably about 10 key points. Give me that year, and the following year, I can guarantee you're going to win 10, 20,000, 30,000 quid a month consecutively. People can't last. People don't have patience. Well, it's life these days. I want to get a book. Okay, right, I'll go onto Amazon. It'll be here tomorrow. And if it isn't here tomorrow, I'm going to get absolutely nuts. Or what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk into the supermarket. I want to get served within 3 seconds. People do not have patience, and they're coming out. They have no patience. Right, I'm going to stay in for 2 weeks. What do you mean 2 weeks? You need to stay in for the next 2 months, 6 months. This is what you've got to do. You've got to come in with a clear head. So when our training academy, you go into it, you're taking it in. And I mean, you're taking it in because you slept well the night before and you've eaten well and you're just in the right frame of mind. They don't do it. They know best, right? Well, you're only doing that because you're the boss and you want to earn loads of money. No, we've given you a position and we're telling you what you've got to do to earn success. And a majority of the success that comes is you've got to give these 8 to 10 points. Providing you do that, unless you really mess up and there's something going on in your past that you can't get around, you're going to have success. People just don't take it. They know better, right? And it is. You see the Ferraris, the Lamborghinis. You see loads of hot beds. You know, you got lots of Emirates hostesses. You know, you can go to the beach. You know, when should we go to the beach? Let's go 3 weeks Saturday. It's a hot day. You haven't got to cancel it. It's not like having a barbecue here. Like, my birthday's going to be in 2 weeks, but we might have to cancel it and go to the pub. But people just don't have patience. Patience is underrated. Like, how do you get success? I worked hard, or, you know, there's all these different things. No one really talks about patience, do they?
I think it's a millennial thing, isn't it? I think to a degree, or whatever the next generation, there's a whole other set now, isn't there, after the millennials? But I think the reality is people aren't that patient. And, you know, from a business perspective, you've interviewed a lot of people who, you know, built a lot bigger businesses than us, I'm sure. But most of them have probably had at least 5, 6, 7, 8 years of really hard graft before you even see yourself coming out the ground, right?
Yeah.
I think for us, certainly, we were probably going... probably 7 out of those 10 years, you know, we were still very much the underdogs and all the rest of it. It's easy now for other people to look at it and say, oh, that's easy. It's okay for you to say whatever. But actually, it's probably only in the last few years that then that's really, you know, really started taking off. You have to build and build and build and build all those foundations to be able to put yourself in a position. But the people don't want, as Luke just said, people don't want to wait that long, right? If I'd say to you, you've got to spend 10 years doing something before you're successful, sounds like a long time, doesn't it?
And it's like I say, Steve, it's been going 10 years. Let's make no like mistake. The first 7 years were shit. We could have earned substantially more money working as a broker for another firm. We wouldn't have had the hassle and the stress of a potential bounce check. You could have gone home to your family earlier. You could have left in the morning a bit later. You pretty much could have done what you want, and you could have, you know, you look after yourself. So for 7 years to try and build something, to write, okay, shall we go and take that 10,000 square foot office? The market wasn't good now. So what people can't say is House & House has just become the successor of Dubai in the last kind of 3 years since it started going on Instagram and, you know, Facebook and all these kind of things. It was building for a long time, and there's some bold, you know, moves. Like, we took an office, I think, literally COVID just, I remember having a conversation with James and Simon. COVID had just finished. And Simon's like, let's go and get a 10,000 square foot office. And I'm like,
well, I'm not sure it really finished, but with the lockdown,
we were in it, or something was going on. But it was the most fucking bizarre thing I've ever heard someone say. Like, mate, who's coming to Dubai? It's COVID. Why do you want to go and get another 10,000 square foot? Rents were down, and we could see them coming out. Yeah, we got a really good deal. Yeah. But it's like, in these difficult times, cut back on your marketing, lay off your staff. You know, we had to make some unfortunate decisions. We had to cut some things here and there. But we did it for the good of the company. Our salaries got reduced significantly, as you would expect. But, you know, up till 2019... we were doing shit, you know. We weren't living in nice houses or nice watches and nice, you know, cars. We were on nice holidays for sure. So it was really that patience. And that's what I just think, any of the people you've interviewed, the success comes from people. Like you in boxing, right? You can get knocked down a lot of times, but expect it. Get up, dust yourself off, retrain. And like I say to my son, you know, tomorrow you're 1% better. Just try. That's it.
Yeah, it's the I use boxing all the time as like an analogy, metaphor, whatever you want to call it, because it literally is like that. When 12 rounds represents, let's say, 12 rounds of business. Yeah. Like during the first couple of rounds, you might be sussing it out, just touching, having a little look. And then suddenly, the fight's on, you start advancing forward and you're thinking, this is actually getting quite easy now. And then suddenly a recession comes.
Yeah.
Now you're in the back foot and you're actually being beaten and you're getting hurt.
Yeah.
And some people at that point will just take the knee and give up and walk out of there, which is actually fair enough. Some people know that they're going to get beaten and they just don't have the heart to carry on.
Yeah.
But if you can dodge and weave, and if you can persevere and ride the shots out and turn it around and then either knock it out or finish strong, that's how you become a winning business or winning individual. Guys, I wanted to hop on here to once again thank the sponsors of this week's podcast, iSecure Vehicles. When we were searching around for sponsors for the channel, we honestly wanted to get a brand, a company that would give massive amount of value to our audience, and that is definitely iSecure Vehicles. They have a wide range of products which are designed to keep your vehicle, your asset, safe and secure. Some of those products are dash cameras, undetected immobilizers, and car tracking systems. Head over to iSecure to look at their products and make sure you say that the Stephen Sully Study podcast sent you there. I was going to ask you this earlier, but because we're on this conversation, I think it's right to ask you now. I mentioned Charlie Mullins has been on my podcast twice, Pimlico Plumbers, you know, very funny guy, very successful guy, very out there guy. I do like him. We've got a lot of time for him. And I like the fact that he just says how it is.
Yeah.
Let's look at the facts. Started a business as a plumber, literally, you know, sorting out blocked toilets with poo pissed down it to scaling the company and selling it for 150 million. I mean, that is take some doing.
Yeah.
And he's quite flamboyant with his money and stuff, and I just really, really like him. What I like, though, is how honest he was when he nearly lost the business.
Yeah.
He said that there was a time when he had a few receivers in and a few receivers told him, it's curtains, mate, it's lights out, you're not going to win. One of them turned around to him and said, look, you're probably going to lose your house, but if you fight for it, there could be a chance that you could keep it. Mm. He fought. Not only did he keep his house, he kept his business afloat and turned it around and sold it. So my question to you is, you touched on it a little bit, but has there been moments in 10 years where you thought, this is getting the better of us now and I might not see this through, it could fall by the wayside, or where it got really tough and you thought to yourself, I don't know if I fancy this anymore?
I think I don't know whether we would have sat around the three of us and said, look, let's chuck in the towel. Did we go home and you maybe had dinner one night when we're not together and think, how long are we going to fucking do this for, guys? We're absolutely busting your balls away from your family. You know, your mum's in the UK, your dad's in the UK, your brother's in the UK. You probably want to spend time with your family. We're sacrificing that. It's hard to deal with the kids because you're not getting home early. We weren't, I think Simon was saying to me, look, Luke, my expenses are more than my income. I was like, well, that can't last for too long, right? We didn't have loads of money.
That's always been a concept.
Simon likes to spend.
I think maybe because we've got three of us individually, you would probably have a bad day, right? And I know James comes to me, oh, all these people earn more money than me. Well, this is shit. Well, you know, all the agents working more money than me. And I had to, you know, occasionally you've got to remind each other that, look, the reason you're doing this is not for today or tomorrow or even next week or next month. It's for 5 years' time. And that persistence and consistency to, you know, for long term to get there. So I think, you know, so that's the advantage of having a few of you where you're all pulling in the right direction. If anyone's having a bad day, you can, put each other back on track. I think probably for me, COVID was one time when we were sat around in lockdown. In Dubai in lockdown, they literally, you had a police app that you had to fill in a thing to go to the supermarket. Once, I think two or three times a week.
Yeah.
So I remember one time where I actually went and sold some house because I booked an appointment to go to a supermarket. I went there, popped in there to get a receipt, bought some washing powder or something just quickly, and went and sold a house in the hour and a half slot that I had to get out the house and get back in again, which was just quite fun. But I think that was the one time when we were sat around thinking, wow, you know, what's going to happen here? You can't leave the house. We've got all these staff to pay. We've got still, even though obviously brokers on commission only, there is a lot. We've got a lot of salary staff, marketing, admin, you know, back office support, all this kind of stuff. And that was definitely a time that was like, shit, what are we going
to
do?
We had to get some really difficult discussions to put people onto like half salaries. But we always made sure and said, look, we're going to do this, guys. But when it comes back, you're going to get whatever we owe you, you're getting paid back. 6 months later, everyone's paid back.
At Christmas time, we managed to give everyone
these things are hearsay, right? Oh, yeah, well, every company's going to do that, or everyone with morals is going to do it. There's fucking lots that didn't. But we actually said, yeah, we're going to do it. And that's the, I think, the kind of people we are. It's the way we kind of, you know, I want to treat you as I expect to be treated myself, right? I'm never going to tell you to do something that I wouldn't do myself. When we started the business, Simon was going around houses, putting the for sale boards up. So these kind of things aren't, I know it's not like maybe Charlie kind of going and clearing out a shitty toilet, but we're putting up for sale boards ourselves, you know, going out, taking pictures, sweating your balls off and, you know, all these things that maybe wouldn't be expected if someone saw house in house today.
And it's what I was going to say is testament to your integrity, but also at the same time, culture.
Yeah.
I know loads of different words on social media today are battered around in different industries. I mean, the one I hear a lot in boxing, because obviously, you know, I box and I know a lot of boxers is, yeah, I'm a fucking warrior.
Yeah.
You've had two fights, mate. You're not a warrior, are you? Yeah. Like, Mike Tyson's a warrior. George Groves is a warrior. Yeah. You know, these Mick Conlon is a warrior.
Yeah.
But, you know, they've done 25, 30 fights. They've been knocked down, broke their jaw, got back up and fought and won.
Yeah.
You can't say you're a warrior after two fights, mate. I like the positivity.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. But be careful using these titles.
Yeah.
And companies are the same. Yeah, we've got a winning culture. Well, you ain't, have you? Like, you don't put all the work in. You know, you complain about certain things. And there's a bit of slight winning culture when it suits you and then slight loser culture when things are not going so right. Culture. You have to have a winning culture, especially if you're turning over 50 million a year and soon to be 100 million and you've got over 300 employees. How, like, three of us in a room, I would say it'd probably be quite easy for us to have a winning culture between us. You don't really know me so much, but I feel just as I got to know you, I feel like I could create a winning culture with you guys and we go out and do something, right? But then we have 4 people, 5 people, 100 people, 200 people. The fear is the more people you have, the culture will get diluted as time goes on. How do you maintain winning culture across 300 people?
It's bloody hard, but you've got to lead from the top. You've got to drive it from the top. You've got to be, you know, people are always watching Simon. They're always watching Luke. They're always watching James. They're watching the sales director. They're watching the top people are driving the culture. So if you walk into the kitchen and you see that tissue on the floor and you just walk past it because you're paying the cleaners pick it up, shit like that drives your culture, right? So it leads from the top. And I think we've got some really good people in place. We've got 5 values. Stick to those 5 values and they drive our behaviors. There's a lot of people, like you say, about the warrior. And it's like we get people that, you know, the thing I hear quite a lot is about the chimp paradox, you know. Well, I went out and got shit-faced last night and I didn't turn up to what the next day. Yeah, but Luke, I didn't do it. The chimp did it. So everyone's jumping on this bandwagon that wasn't me.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, it was my chimp. I think it's just an excuse. It's a reason. They've heard it. They've seen it or what have you. And it kind of, it wasn't me. It was the chimp. So we drive it and we have external help. We got, you know, probably one of the best real estate trainers in the world that we bring in 2-3 times a year. We spend a huge amount of money on training. We have a training academy. So we're constantly pulling things out. One of our best, I think it was about 2 years ago, one of our best brokers, he was bringing us in a phenomenal amount of money. We had to sack him because he didn't drive the culture. He wasn't a good person. It just wasn't right. But it's a really difficult decision, isn't it? You've got one of your top billers in the company who's bringing you in money every single month and usually you haven't got to have any conversations. He just does it. But he pisses off your clients. He pisses off his colleagues and he pisses off everyone else. So what do? Do you leave it and then think, well, the colleague he's pissing off actually doesn't do that well, doesn't make any money. But it's not just him, it's everyone else. So when you've got 300 odd people, I think we're pretty, pretty spot on with when you can see the cancer, you cut it out straight away.
And it's a bit like the Sir Alex Ferguson model, right? He'll go into Manchester United, look at all the players that are good, but have the wrong culture and the wrong mindset and get rid of them. Even though, let's say short term, it might damage the result. Long term, it grows into a phenomenal team. And David Beckham isn't bigger than Manchester United. Yeah. Wayne Rooney isn't bigger than Manchester United. Making house and house number one.
Yeah.
And then any other person that plugs into it is there to factor into the results and also the culture. And it takes a very special individual to keep that.
We speak a lot.
It is tough, isn't it? I think it's probably a little bit easier now with scale. I think when it was really difficult was when you're a bit smaller and you're not, you know, you are struggling to pay the bills and all the rest of it. I think it's almost easier now. But getting through to that point has been quite tough.
Can I ask this question? I think I asked before off air, but not asking you to name any names, but I'm just curious, right? Sun, the birds, drinking, all the best restaurants in the world, all the best clubs in the world, yacht. I mean, even getting a yacht over there is relatively dirt cheap, right?
Yeah.
Like you get a yacht in comparison to Ibiza.
It's a lot cheaper.
It's mad. And you get a big, big yacht and you have a really, really good time. Then you compound that with earning good money, let's say 20, 30, 40, 50 grand a month, 100 grand a month. And then the ego. I don't care who you buy. Yeah. If you're earning 100 grand a month and you're the golden boy or golden girl of a company, there is a bit of look who I am. Even if you're not saying the words, there is that feeling. Even the best of us, there's going to be moments where you go a bit crazy and you do something you shouldn't have done. Have you had women, but probably predominantly men, who have been a little bit like a dog let off the lead and he's going around just biting whatever he could bite and it's hard to control that individual?
Salespeople are pretty, it's kind of, we teach you to get on it, you know, first thing, you know, drive, passion, all these kind of things. And you've got a stereotypical salesperson, lady or male or female, and they come in and they do. We had probably about a year ago, there's probably been quite a few events. We've had people roll their cars pissed up and then we've called them the next day the phone's off, then 24, 48 hours later, realise they just went home, packed the suitcase and got out because they don't want to be caught. They're over the limit and they've just gone. We had a scenario where someone's gone to a UFC boxing event, had too much to drink, and then there's something like, I don't actually think this person was involved, but he's from the UK. And do you know what? He's a lovely, lovely guy. But aren't we all until maybe we've had too many tequilas? He actually was speaking with the sales director. And I think, again, you know, with that, we kind of sit people down. We're having their one-to-ones with them, trying to understand, okay, what are your issues? You got anything that we need to learn about that we can help you with? Maybe, you know, his family had a few issues with this and, you know, he's a bit of a loose cannon. All right. So actually at the time, he's staying off the booze. So I think he stayed off the booze for about 6 weeks and he did tremendously well. And he was doing really well before that time. So, you know, he's going to the gym, he's doing all these things, goes to the UFC and something's happened with his mate. He's then hit someone from the back, in the back of the head. And the guy's turned around, he's got a police logo on his... So out of all the people you can hit watching the UFC, you hit an undercover police officer. So you're fucked, aren't you? Right? Don't do that.
Him?
So he went down. So he went to jail. I think actually this is the whole Dubai story, right? If you look at the media, it probably would have said 2 years, but it was about 2 months.
I think it was about 2 months, and yeah, something like that. I think yeah. Obviously, the standard route is they let you out fairly sooner than probably what the press would say, as Luke mentioned, and then deport you, which has always been the way for, you know, anyone caught drink driving in the last 20 years. It's, you know, it's typical sort of month in prison, deport you. I think some of those laws are even changing now, and I don't think a lot of that deportation stuff doesn't really happen anymore.
And, you know, the crazy thing is now, we spoke to him after, he's actually allowed back into Dubai. So he can come back now. So again, you look at it.
So that's quite an extreme story, right? Where you just pulled a funny face. Yeah, and yet he can probably come back.
I quit because I'm like, oh my God. Like,
he's a scouser. He's a nice lad. And he told me, he's like, Luke, tell any broker not to go to jail. Into like, he was in Abu Dhabi, but he said like Dubai could be similar.
It'll put you off for sure.
Yeah. But anyway, he was talking of coming back. Honestly, Steve, we wouldn't take him back now. And again, you know, we practice what we preach. We won't do that. So, we set the standard. It goes back to our culture. Guys, if you want to go out and be an absolute reprobate, and I do get it. We were young once. I've done plenty of stupid things. I do get it. And, you know, you have to learn from your mistakes, but we just can't bring it into house and house.
There's a few pillars that make a successful company. And there's a couple of different variations depending on who you speak to, but there's the culture, there's the product, there's the marketing, there's sales, there's the brand, there's all this kind of stuff. You clearly have got that within House and House, and that's led on to other opportunities, including the Dubai Hustle, the TV show on BBC Three. And I've just watched a couple of little bits and pieces on there. And I saw my mate Charlie Bannon on there having a little conversation.
Yeah.
The Dubai Hustle... From an outsider, I think that's a really, really good thing, because I think it from your sales or employment perspective, it must have done wonders. But also, there's going to be a new demographic that didn't know who you were or didn't really know too much about Dubai or UAE. Now they do, and now they're buying. And they may not tell you, but that's part of the reason why they've come into your funnel or come over and start speaking to you. Dubai Hustle, though, how did that come around and how much of an impact has it had on House and House?
I mean, they contacted us, actually. They were looking to do a show about, you know, Dubai real estate market, that kind of aspirational idea of young people moving from the UK, typically, obviously being BBC, from the UK to Dubai. And that's how it came about. They contacted apparently three or four companies. They were actually speaking to James, weren't they? James did a good job. Luke and I weren't massively interested, really. So we just sort of said, oh, well, whatever, you speak to James. James was probably speaking to him for a year. I think in the end, there were actually two different production companies, both looking to do a similar thing. And they both picked us, House and House, as a company they wanted to do it on. And then we ended up being in the, you know, privileged position to be able to pick which production company we wanted to go with.
It's a really difficult decision, Steve, isn't it? Because you're going to allow a film crew to come into your office. And at that stage, it wasn't 350 or whatever it was. It probably was about 250. But you're getting a film crew to come into your office, stand around 8, 9, 10 hours a day and film brokers, money hungry, charging people 10,000, 20,000, colleagues fighting, accusing them of stealing their clients, don't do this, don't do that. There is a chance it doesn't look good to the public.
It can expose you.
It can expose you. And again, you can look, you've got someone there, you know, someone else will sit there and say, well, any exposure is good exposure. And, you know, today's news, tomorrow's fish and chip paper. But, you know, in the interest of the company, I think we probably kind of discarded it for a couple, 2-3 years. I'm not sure, but I think we're probably the first real estate company to put out a TV show. And subsequently, since us, maybe people have seen, it hasn't gone that bad for them. So a few others have jumped on the bandwagon. Ours was a lot different. It wasn't selling Sunset. You haven't got, you know, we've got some really glamorous housing to buy. You have got a lot of restrictions. You've got a lot of laws. And, you know, you've got a lot of people that in, like these kind of clients that are people that you speak to, when they're earning 100 million quid, dollars, whatever it may be, they don't necessarily want people filming their houses and showing their art and doing all these kind of things. So we've done it from a different perspective. We've kind of shown people that maybe if you're 18, like Luke, and you've got some really shit results, life isn't over. And don't let anyone tell you it is over. If you don't get the university you want, it's not over. You can do something about it. It's just up to you. So what we're showing is we're showing people that maybe come from unprivileged backgrounds, you maybe whatever it may be, but they're going up north, they're 18, 19, 20, and they've just go, okay, let's show you people that have come out here. They've gotten a plane, and getting on that plane is a difficult thing in leaving your family, but they're coming out and they're going on commission only. If they don't sell a property, they are not getting anything. That is the way it goes. So you can go down your high street agency in the UK and you can earn your 20, 25 grand. If you've got a good position as a base salary, you can get a shit commission, which would be like 200-300 quid. I was speaking to someone that was selling Porsches recently. I think they got 200 quid if they sell a Porsche. That's going to give you a comfort zone, right? I've got 20,000 quid and I'm close to my parents and I can go around there for, you know, a roast dinner on Sunday. If you want to jump on a plane, go 8 hours and back yourself that if I don't sell, I don't own anything. But if I do sell, average commission at the moment, 10,000 quid, something like that, Si? 8,000
to the broker, yeah. I think the average on the resi team is about 86,000 dirhams, I think, when I checked recently. So that's about 18 grand is a gross fee, and they get their 50% of that. So they do £9,000 tax free.
So 50%
for selling one house.
It's great. So on average, so roughly how many sales reps have you got? And on average, how much do they earn each and every single month?
Sales reps at the moment has gone up. So we divide them into two categories. You've got people selling resi houses, like they're coming out to see Steve. Steve needs to sell his house and they'll come and see you. Or you've got another department called off plan. So you've got a building that's going to, it's a patch of sand, Steve. It's going to be built in 3 years. They sell you the dream. They show you all the facilities. It's going to be the next thing, sliced bread, but it's going to be in 3 years. Do you want to buy it? So you've got these two different sides.
We've got 150 between the two salespeople. The rest of them on top of that would be leasing. I haven't got the average number for you, I'm afraid. But it varies hugely. I mean, yeah, we got someone who's as Luke probably mentioned earlier, earned over £1 million in 6 months.
He started 6 months. So this isn't a guy, so I kind of go against what I said earlier. He started with us in March. And today he's around over a million quid,
but net to him, tax free, within 6 months. And which is obviously, that's obviously a wild success story, all the way through to people who are really struggling and might be going home in 6 months. So you do get a huge, that kind of idea of the champagne and the razor blades, you get a huge sliding scale.
Yeah.
So, okay, because I'm interested in sales because I see myself as a salesperson, right? Yeah. I started in sales at 19, 20 years of age. And when I found sales, because I never knew it existed, believe it or not, I felt there was only plumbers and there was only the regular jobs. And I found sales and it was like the promised land for me. When someone said to me, I don't care about your age, your gender, your race, your background, your qualifications, I don't give a shit about any of that. I just care about your attitude.
Yeah.
You need a good attitude.
Yeah.
I was like, that's me. Bang. Yeah. It was very difficult, but then eventually I started making 10, 20, and then I was getting up to like 80 grand a month, et cetera, commissions. And I'm always intrigued in different industries, certainly in different companies and also different parts around the world. Mm. Is it all down to the salesperson, or is it also down to the product and also the brand they're working for? And also another sort of bolt-on part to this question is, what actually makes a good salesperson?
Patience. Okay, I've got to say that after what we've said, right? But we've had bricklayers come out to us, right? You speak to them over Zoom. Maybe don't come across as the sharpest tool in the box, but, you know, go out in hail, rain or snow, throw loads of steel up in the air, scaffolders. You know, there's all these different kind of jobs that you wouldn't necessarily think they're going to be a good salesperson, but maybe they go in the pub in the evening, have a bit of banter with their mates, and they're like, you've got the gift of the gab. It's really difficult to define. We've had people come that worked at Rolls-Royce, we've had people that worked at Porsche, and then they come in and they're absolutely shite. So maybe because they worked at Rolls-Royce and they've worked at Porsche and they've had the best sales training, their ego tells them that I shouldn't work with the bricky or the scaffolder, and I'm going to make it from day one, and they don't. So patience, I think their attitude as well, because they've got to understand they're in a different country. There's a lot of changes from where they're usually coming from, and they've got to be able to listen. And people don't, you know, don't tell me what to do. I've just done it and I've made it, or I'm going to make it. Or, you know, I think there's so much training out there at the moment. We, as I say, we've got one of the best real estate coaches in the world, and we do this, that, and the other. But, you know, if I go home, I can go onto YouTube, right? I can listen to one of your podcasts, listen about the boxer, what did he do, and pick a nugget up from each one of these things. But I've got to keep learning and keep training. And then when I do it, I try implementing it. Maybe I'm going to do a Mel Robbins and high five the mirror in the morning and do all these things. But, you know, statistically proven, if you high five, you've got more chance of having success and, you know, your energy when you come in the office. So there's so many things, Steve, but could we nail down five? Probably not. I think sometimes we go off our gut and be like, you're going to be a sales monster. Come in, don't do it.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, Steve, sales is a big leveler, isn't it? You could take people, it doesn't matter where you're from, what you look like. The best people probably tend to be people who act, this activity for me, they're always on the phone. They're just busy, you know, they're making stuff happen. You're working for a great brand, obviously. We provide all the marketing. We've got a 30-strong marketing team. But ultimately, in terms of listings of properties, it's going to come down to you and your network. And, you know, and the hardest bit is when you come to Dubai, you turn up tomorrow, you probably don't have a network, so you need to make one. Yeah. We've got, you know, database of 150,000 previous clients. So it's all there and it's accessible and it's ready for you to go and build on. But that requires the individual to get there and be like, right, spend that first 6 to 12 months putting the legwork in, meeting some clients and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I think we give them all the tools and for it, and we give them the training and try and make that, you know, reality. I think unless you've done sales before, you probably haven't been used to picking up the phone and getting told to sod off by people and all the rest of it, have you? So that's probably the hardest bit I think people go through. I think in interviews, we tell them, you know, have you ever made cold calls? Oh, well, you know, a little bit, I don't mind it. And then in the real world, when they do start, they suddenly go, oh shit, I don't like that, you know? So I'd say that's probably the toughest bit. And if
we have a lot of patience with them as well, right? So it comes from our side to have the patience, right? Someone can come in day one and they don't set the world alight. And, you know, there's a lot of companies, you know, maybe top five, maybe top 10 in Dubai that, you know, you go in 4 weeks later, if you've not done a deal, get out. They won't allow it. Maybe there's another company, they give you 6 weeks, maybe another one give you 8. We've had some people come to us, they've not done a deal for 6 months. Actually, that shows, okay, right, you haven't done a deal for 6 months, but can we see something in you that could change? Because something could change quite quickly. So we've had people that have maybe not done as well as they had hoped for 6 to 8 months, but we persevered. We got Charlie Bannon, who's an amazing sales director. He can pretty much sum a lot of people up. Right, do this. So when you come in tomorrow, I need you to do X, Y, Z. Then I want you to write back to me at 5 p.m. that day exactly what you did do. Do the same every day for the next week, and then we'll meet again next week. Keep doing that. If people follow what he says, he's done it, he's really good at it, and he's seen hundreds of people be successful. Follow what he tells you, you should do it.
It's a recipe, right? You know, if someone says, I want to make the best spaghetti bolognese. Well, what you need is spaghetti pasta. You need the minced meat. You need some onions in there, chopped tomatoes, and you need to cook it for this amount of time. And they come off the recipe and off the duration you meant to cook it.
Yeah.
And they complain when they got a bundle of mush or mush and they moan about it. Well, did you follow the recipe? No, that's on you.
But why don't they? Yeah. Why can't they follow the recipe? When you speak to why can't they do it?
Well, I think people are always looking for an easy way out. And unfortunately, you know, they try and, you know, you know, as someone like Josh would say, you can't text your way to success, right? If you're trying to build relationships with people, me sending you a text when I've never met you, going, "Hi, Steve, can I sell your house?" Probably not even going to reply, are you?
Yeah.
So that's why a lot of it's, and in terms of, you know, us giving people the time they need to succeed, provided they're putting the work rate in, they're putting the effort in, and the persistency, then you would give them the opportunity.
So basically, everyone at the moment thinks in the world, right, what I can do is I want to sell something. I've got a list of all the buyers. What I'm going to do is send them a bulk WhatsApp message, and they can see these blue ticks. So back then they're eating their lunch thinking, well, he's read it, but he hasn't replied. And then they've sent out 3,000 and they've got like no replies. And they're thinking, why? Because every other Tom, Dick and Harry's doing that. And how do you build a relationship over WhatsApp? But I don't want to call them, because if I call them, I could catch Steve when he's doing his podcast. Yeah, but if you catch Steve when he's doing his podcast, he'll have a missed call. And if he doesn't call you back, then you call him the next day and say, Steve, look, you missed my call yesterday. Have you got 29 seconds? I want to tell you about this new development. So it's a bit harder than selling WhatsApp, but these are right. It's not rocket science. We're estate agents. I don't want to put the industry down, but we're not the brightest of sparks, are we? We show someone the house. They either like it or they don't. I can't tell you that the bathroom's got Italian marble and you'd be, all right, I'm going to buy it now. My wife loves it. Yeah, if your wife loves it, it's going to help. But I've got to join the dots. I've got to think, right, okay, the property that you want might not be built for the next 4 years, but there's 5,000 developments going on and I need to think of the one that you might like or your wife might like. So there's sales tactics and all this kind of stuff, but the easy route, people want the easy route. Mm. Let's WhatsApp and let's send it blanket emails.
Every business has to turn over a profit and it's about the bottom line. I know as founders, I'm a founder, and the political answer, you could say, yeah, it's about the clients. And that's all true. I know it's all true.
Yeah.
But the reality is all of that falls by the wayside if there is no profit.
Yeah.
And part of the reason why we do the sacrifice and not see our kids, blood, sweat and tears, and moments where we think, is this all worth it, is for that bottom line. And then hopefully to enjoy some of that bottom line after you've invested the rest for your future, to open doors and to do other stuff. How important is money to all three of you?
Yeah, massively.
Yeah, I think anyone would be lying if they said it wasn't important. I think it's more the ability to provide you with, you know, you and your family with whatever you need, but also that freedom to be able to, you know, and now 10 years in, to be able to spend a bit more time in the summer, you know, taking the kids on holiday, and they've got, you know, 2 months off for the summer holidays, being able to get away has been really good. And I think it's more about that freedom, really. The money becomes just a number, but actually it's the time and the freedom it can buy you. I think it's probably more relevant.
And because the buyer has the watches there, the lovely restaurants, the malls, the sun, the yachts, the Ferraris, the Lamborghinis, because you're already around it, is that kind of a thing that doesn't really bother you no more? In actual fact, because you have got the money, it allows you to get those kind of things.
I think when you haven't got it, you look at that and be like, I really want it, don't you? You know, you mentioned watches. You can go and buy a couple of watches, and actually, then when you bought it, you're like, you thought you really wanted it, and then you go, I'm not really that fussed, actually. So I think when you're around it for a long, long time, I think, and then you are in a fortunate position maybe to be able to afford those things, you actually sometimes just say, well, actually, look, if I have what I need, I don't really need it.
Isn't it like
another one, you know?
Money doesn't make you happy, but the absence of money makes you unhappy, or something like that. So, and it's like a lot of things, isn't it? You get, like Simon says, you get the watch. 2 weeks later, you don't like the watch, right? Or you don't not necessarily not like it, but there's the next model, or there's the Patek, and after the Patek, there's that other Swiss kind of. So look, there is a bottom line. What I would say, and again, I hate saying these kind of things, because when I say it, I'm thinking people are going to listen to it thinking, well, of course he's going to say that. But numerous scenarios, we're actually dealing, Simon and I in London, our business is in Dubai, we're actually dealing with a transaction at the moment where the broker has not necessarily said the truth to the buyer. So the client buying the house thinks that the tenant is going to leave on a certain month, when actually the tenant isn't going to leave on a certain month. So what that essentially means is, Steve, someone's buying a house, but they can't actually move into it when they want to move into it. And that's then going to affect where they're putting the kids in school. It's going to affect, the wife's going absolutely berserk. So what we've done is they've not paid a fee. Plus, we've then compensated them massively. And we've also gone back to them, said, if you don't want to go ahead with the transaction, you can come out of it. So you've got option one, come out of it. Doesn't matter. You don't buy the house. Yeah, but we really like it. But yeah, but the tenant's a problem. All right, well, what do you need? Well, we don't want to pay you your fee, and we want compensation of X, Y, and Z. The fact of the matter is, if we wanted to go down the legal route, they probably would have a lot difficult stance, and they probably wouldn't get anything from it. The contract signed, it was in there, you just didn't. Yes, the broker said this, but it's a lot of hearsay. We've brought everyone involved in the transaction into a room. We've had a conversation. We admit we're wrong, and you're getting the compensation. I know it's easy to say, but you try and find to buy any agency. But here you've got a lot of red tape. You've got lawyers that look into it and a lot of this kind of stuff. This is what we breed. The reason that happens, Steve, is that then goes out. That sets a stance. That's our culture. You don't mislead your clients, because if you do, you're going to be punished financially. So there are brokers unhappy at the moment, but they're not going to not tell the truth next time. Or they're not, maybe I did tell the truth, but I just said it in a different kind of way. Whatever you said, the client didn't understand, because they decided to buy on the fact that that tenant was leaving. So I know it's kind of a bit of a long story on it, but we do things the right way, where Steve and his wife buy a property, they're happy. And also what they do is, if anyone says, look, move into a new country, think about it. Dubai, what's it grown in the last 6-12 months? 300,000 population, maybe?
Yeah, maybe even a bit more, actually.
So you've got different nationalities. You've got Russians coming in. You've got America. You've got loads of Europeans. You've got all these different nationalities. They're scared. You're doing one of the biggest things in life. You're buying a property. So we've got to do the right thing and make sure that that person buys the right property ethically. And that's what drives our culture, and that's what we want to do.
Although the population's quite big, I still feel it still feels like a small city. You come to London, and I'm like, wow, this is what a massive place, especially being a country lad at heart. But Dubai's still small enough where I don't think you can't go around and upset everyone. You know, you need to have having that very strong reputation is so important to us, because we're not worried about right now or the next 2 years. We're worried about the next 10 years. We've got a lot of years of school fees to pay, haven't we, Luke?
You've got to sleep at night. Honestly, you've got to sleep. I can go out and we can do a deal and we can earn an extra £1 million over the next year by doing. Simon can earn £1 million, I can earn £1 million, James can earn £1 million, brokers can earn lots of money, and we can have this dance. Guys, go out there and rip everyone else off. I won't sleep at night. Would I like it to happen to me? Would I like it to happen to you? So I think from the top, you need to have ethics and culture that lead down. And that is ours. We don't want this to happen. And if we hear it does, and it gets back to us, because usually it does, we get phone calls, because I'm like, we're the top three on the website, meet the team, James, Luke, Simon, right, phone call. We deal with it, and we deal with every single one. You know, 1,000 Google reviews, I think we're 4.8. You know, you will see that even if there are bad ones, we'll deal with it. We get involved. So it's not now we pass it down. So we're pretty much hands-on in that business, watching the brokers, everyone. And you know, a lot of them are doing a really good job. So I'm not trying to, I'm just giving you these scenarios and not put it across in the way, well, they're going to say that. Because honestly, we practice what we preach.
I'm going to ask you only three more questions and then we'll round up the podcast. And this is what I want to ask you. You've made a few quid. You've got the accolades. You're on bloody TV. You got a nice lifestyle. You know, you get along really well. I mean, it appears you have everything. You're living in a lovely part of the world, which is the new America almost.
Yeah.
Why don't you just kind of retire now, take a few quid, relax in the sun, have a yacht, be with the kids, be with your family? Why don't you just put all that stress and worry and the 4.8 Google reviews to bed and say, I've done my part now, and I'm hanging out.
I don't think it's quite the we haven't quite reached the destination we want to, and we've got a new and revived 5-year plan, which is to get us to the 100 million sterling a year. So yeah, that's
I think it's going back to the watch, isn't it? Right, it's never enough. But
it's part of the game, isn't it? It's part of the fun. And actually, my kids get to school every day, last time I checked. So they get to school at 7:30 in the morning. My ADHD couldn't keep me in the house past about 7:45. So, you know, I'd be bored as hell, you know?
Yeah,
no, person.
And probably completely off the rails. So I need to do something every day. So.
I was away. I took 5 weeks off in the summer. I think I probably had 15 Zooms while I was away. I was in Marbella and, you know, doing this kind of stuff. Love it. We genuinely love the grind and getting in and people seeing us. And I think that's a big shift as well, you know, when people get more successful in the businesses and they start taking less time away, you know, maybe the employees might tell you something different, but they like seeing us, even if it's, you know, just a quick chat in the morning, or you maybe just giving us a bit of advice. They know the answer, but I just want to swing it past you. I think they really like it. So what time? We're definitely the first in the office, I would say. We're definitely in there.
Yeah, unless we've got something else to do. Luke usually beats me in there. But as I said, kids in Dubai go to school at 7:30 in the morning. Yeah. So I wouldn't have it any other way. You know, you need some direction in your life. And we're too young for... I'm 38 years old. I'm not ready to retire.
For me, it's not the money now. It's not the money. It's the
purpose.
That's what keeps you going, right? Yeah,
the purpose to drive the mission.
It's like, you know, you get up in the morning, you go to the gym, you're in the gym for 5:30, you get your sweat on, you get in the office for 7:45, that's life. We can speak in, I'm 42, so let's say 15 years, 57. No, I still think I'll have a good engine going, you know. And I think it kind of sets... I saw my dad hustle. I saw him grinding. I saw it. He ran a pub and, you know, he'd be coming to bed at 3 a.m. Then he'd be getting up when the beer's being delivered in the barrels, near the barrels outside. I think it's what your kids see as well. And it's kind of like, I think my kids see that. And, you know, I think that gets you somewhere
there.
Yeah,
you're setting an example. So leads on to my next question, which you just touched on, Simon, which is the vision... The next goal is the plan for House and House. I mean, you mentioned about the 100 million turnover. You might be thinking about, rather than 347 staff members or whatever it is, maybe 900 staff members. Is House and House going to expand into Abu Dhabi? Is it going to go to Saudi Arabia? Is it going to go to Australia? Is it going to come back here to the UK? What is the next plans and the vision for House and House over the next 10, 15, 20 years?
I mean, we've always wanted to focus on Dubai, to be honest with you, just because we feel like very strongly that we should, you know, work and focus on the market that we know really well. So rather than running around, if we wanted to bring this to the UK, I'm not convinced how well it'd work. I'm also not convinced that how exciting a state agency in the UK is, to be completely honest with you. Yeah. And it's not something I would want to, Luke touched on earlier, if you had to do it again, would you do it? Probably not. And I definitely wouldn't want to do it in the UK. But in Dubai, we want to focus to be the best real estate company in Dubai. We're currently in the top sort of 4 or 5. And that revenue thing is not just about a revenue number. It's about scale and about having a market share. So having a significant market share in the Dubai market, is that those are the kind of bits that we're really focusing on for the next decade. Cool. And then maybe that retirement bit will come in 10 or 15 years time when this kid's finished school.
Maybe. I think what is really interesting, you said, you know, I think the power is definitely shifting from the west to the east, right? And we can see it politically, what's going on, and we can see the issues going on in the big powerhouse that is the US. I really think it's going to be so interesting to see what Saudi, Qatar, Kuwait, UAE does over the next 15 years. I think it's going to be ridiculous. Honestly, if there's one, my kids are there, so hopefully they've already got the head start by being there. But I remember speaking to my niece about a year ago. She said, "What bit of advice have you got?" She thinks maybe you could give me something. I'm like, move to the Middle East. So wherever you go, whatever you do, you will have that springboard. So that is really, for us, is kind of like a dream ticket. Okay, right, we can do this. We can expand here. You know, we can do all this. But a lot of it as well, okay, right, keep your feet on the ground. What are you really good at? We're really good at selling properties. So fuck everything else. Let's not try and open discos or try and, you know, sell watches or, you know, let's sell art and do all these. I think everyone starts losing control. Okay, yeah, but we could do with the extra revenue here. We could turn the group into this. We could do that. Let's just focus on what we're really good at, right? If you go to see the doctor, let's see the doctor, because that's what the doctor does.
Yeah.
So I think that's key to focus. Going back early to what you said, be massively focused. So we need focus as well, right? That's what we should be given, is focus. And what's our focus?
Defo.
And there's no doubt the whole Middle East has got a lot of cash, and that's why there's all these noise being made. I think the one thing with Dubai that stands out with that is, might not be in quite the same cash or oil position, but that it's got a certain buzz to the place. And that's what you can't miss. You know, you miss that in some of these other places, don't you? You've been around various places in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Lots of neighbouring cities that are spending lots of money and, you know, doing the rest of it. But Dubai has got, you come out of this amazing Terminal 3, all Emirates Terminal, and the place has just got a buzz in the air about it. And I think that's what sort of sets it apart, really.
Yeah. You may or may not know this. If you listen to some of my podcasts, I always round off the podcast with the last final statement. I came up with my own mantra, my own kind of
statement or quote many years ago when I first set up my first sales company, and it goes like this: be happy, never content. I've got my own interpretation of what it means.
Yeah. Okay.
But if I were to ask the founders of House & House, what does be happy, never content mean to you guys?
I think you need to appreciate every day, and you need to appreciate where you are and appreciate how fortunate you are. But the never content bit means that the goal always moves, right? Because the game is a never ending. And I think that's what it means to me.
I think it's just that drive in life, Steve, at the moment that, you know, when you wake up, you know, have that breath, be happy that you're still alive, right? We were talking before we went on air about, you know, different things in life that could be kind of killing us that we don't know about, whether it's the sugar or the processed food or all these kind of things. I think a lot of the time we're so in the rush, and I think Dubai's getting like that. And, you know, I certainly feel it here in London at the moment, like people are going 100 miles an hour. When did they actually take a breath and actually think, you know, appreciate where you are, right? Wherever, whatever it is, right? Your family's alive, your family's healthy, you woke up this morning, you got to work, you're not in a war-torn country. There's a lot of shit going on, you know? You could be in Morocco and your house could have just caved in, you know? My wife's from Morocco and this. So I think we've just got to start being happy, and, you know, you've just got to be that good person as well. So I think, you know, as long as you give out those good intentions, that's quite important. So yeah, maybe that's the content bit.
No, I know it's been a long time coming. I really, really appreciate your time. Perhaps when I'm in Dubai, let's call it a couple of years from now, you turn over 100 million.
Yeah.
You might have had Dubai Hustle Part 2, 3, 4, 5 going on.
Yeah.
And some other successes. You've got 900 people working with you. Perhaps I'll come over and we'll do a podcast part 2 in person.
Yeah. Look forward to that. That'll be fun.
Yeah.
Cool.
Thanks.
Really appreciate your time. Thank you very much. Be happy, never content. Make sure you're subscribing and sharing.
Yeah.
And once again, thank you very much for your time.
Cheers. Thanks. Cheers. Thanks. Cheers. Thanks. Cheers.